Are you ready? Why don't we start out with a little show and tell? I don't know if I ever showed you the book that this is actually the translation of. I showed it to you. Yeah, okay. You've seen that.
No, I didn't see it. Oh, I remember.
Have you all seen Adam and Archetype letters? You all seen that? I think I showed you all the Pali Jung.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one in the front.
Yeah, these two I'm pretty sure you haven't seen. Just wanted to make sure I showed you all that. Right. These are just nice general history of physics. More from the standpoint of the personalities. And this is one that Tom referred to last time. It's got a chapter on each of the major players.
What is the title?
Men Who Made a New Physics.
Thank you.
It's very readable. Another one like that, but a little drier, a little more factual, that's more on the feminine side, is the Genius of Science.
The Genius of Science.
Yeah, I'll pass them around. Abraham Pice was a physicist, and also he's done a biography of Einstein, he's done a biography of Niels Bohr, he's also a biographer. If you wanted to read one light book, I'd probably recommend the Barbara Klein book that Tom referred to. It's very readable. You get a feeling for the different guys and the quirks and what was going on. Okay, that's all for show and tell. Should we do a quick review? I thought I'd just kind of canvass everything we've done so far very quickly. Our basic idea in These Dreams of Pali is that because he played such a role in outer historical events, that his unconscious has correspondingly responded with its reaction to those events, so that we're seeing in these dreams not only his personal psychology, but the reaction of the unconscious to the psychology of the time. We've talked about the history of quantum mechanics, the theme that's going to emerge in the reaction of Pali's unconscious to both his personal and to the collective problem is that science's knowledge of the natural world is too small. Our understanding of knowledge needs to increase. A figure that we talked about that we're going to be seeing quite a bit is the stranger or Mercurius. And he called that the archetypal background of our understanding of nature. We'll be seeing more of that. An idea that we're going to be following, not maybe immediately, but eventually, is that we're going to see that the state of science that needs to evolve is paralleled with the state of his own personality that needs to evolve. So that there's going to be an analogy between his own personal life and the worldview of science that's reigning. And part of the importance of that is we're trying to get to an understanding of science and a just general knowledge that is not detached from the person who conceives it. You'd think what could be more objective than science, but we're going to see it's actually got a very subjective side to it. We talked about the split between matter and spirit, or subject and object, starting with Descartes. We did a historical survey of quantum mechanics. But the big thing is there that electrons don't follow predictable trajectories of movement. There's a degree of randomness. That's pretty much what we did. Big ideas to remember: Einstein's ideas challenge the relativity of time. The nature of the atom challenges the idea of causality. And as we observe the different way that we conceive of matter, we're going to see that affects the way we see ourselves. That's the main stuff so far. All sound familiar? Hello, welcome. I was just about to say, I had somebody come up to me at the Friends of Yom Talk and say they wanted to give us a try. So, pull up a chair and we will introduce ourselves and ask you to introduce yourself. Tell us about yourself, your name, and I think you're particularly suited for this material, so tell us a little bit about that.
I'm a retired pharmaceutical chemist of about 35 years. My breath's trying to find something else right here. But as I mentioned to you, I've been interested in this kind of work for a long time. I did do I started off about 15 years ago with the a four-weekend intensive work with group from Blackstone, synthesis group. That got me going, but also I took some courses out of CTS, one of which was Jungian religion, and that furthered my interest in Jung. I've been reading on my own some of the collective art, and that's really what my interest more. So,
great, welcome.
And I did. I'm interested in the quantum mechanical approach. In that, I've always wanted to see what synthesis there might be between religion and basic science.
Okay. Well, welcome. Your name again?
Ted.
I'm Gary. This is
Mary Springer.
Sandy Hurst.
Carolyn Bailey.
Hi, Ted. Welcome. Patty Marble.
Yeah.
I have to see you soon.
Try more.
I mean, why?
Carol Sabisa.
I'm Linda Crocker. I'm Mary Ellen Vine.
You just increased the masculine quotient 300%. It's tough, but we manage. So, well, basically what we've done so far, Ted, we've just... anyway, just doing a review. Let me give you a quick review. So far, we've started with the idea that we're going to look at Pauli's dreams because since he played such a role in the history of Western civilization through the effects of quantum mechanics, that his unconscious reacts with dreams that are not only about him but about our times. So we're looking at his dreams both as they apply to him and as they apply to his despair after the bombs went off in the end of World War II. We've talked about the history of quantum mechanics. You certainly know that. One of the basic things we're going to see in these dreams is that the dreams are saying to us that our knowledge of nature is too narrow. That's going to be trying to get Pauli to understand the extent of what needs to be known about the material world. A big figure that we're going to see in the dreams is called the Stranger. This is all coming up, so you haven't missed anything. And that would represent the archetypal background of our understanding of nature. I'm just sort of giving what we've done up to now, sort of been a preview. I talked about the split between matter and spirit, starting with Descartes. We've talked about Einstein's ideas, and we've talked about the ideas of quantum mechanics in a very basic level. And the challenge that Einstein brought to our concept of time is paralleled by the challenge that quantum mechanics brought to our concept of causality. And we've just done very introductory stuff up to now. Okay, I thought what we'd do, one thing we have not done in the way of introductory material, while we're sort of at a stopping point, is we would look at the relationship between Pauli and Jung in terms of its chronological development, just so you get some sort of feeling for what was going on. And again, this is just in the way of background material. So, where did I put that? I hope I have enough to go around and see if there's...
Okay.
There is a... the text is something we photocopy. I still have another copy of it. So if you want to do this, I'll get it to you. Maybe you could share it with one of these guys in the meantime. What we're working on, Ted, is a translation of this book in German, Wolfgang Pauli and the Spirit of Matter. And it's an interpretation of 40 of Pauli's dreams after the bombs went off until his death. A guy named Finn Erkelens. He's a Dutch physicist.
I have a chance to read Pauli and Jung's letters.
Well, if you've done that, then...
You were mentioning this, I think.
I don't think so.
As a reader?
Oh, the Dave Lindor's Pauli and Jung.
Yeah,
I was part of that. He's a friend.
He's going back there.
Are we out?
No.
Everyone's got one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Just a minute. You got one too?
Yeah.
Okay. Jung's life you're probably familiar with. Let me review it so I can contrast it with Pauli's. Jung was born in 1875. And I always break Jung's life up into four periods. And the first period would go from 1875 to 1913, which is the time that he was raised, got educated, became a psychiatrist, and then worked with Freud. So by 1913, he was a psychoanalyst. You know, the split with Freud happened in 1913. And that began a 15-year period of disorientation, which ended in 1928. And he was 53 years old. By that time, he'd come up with his main idea. What's his main idea? That there's a healing function built into the personality. And that's the self. So, no matter how you got messed up, there's something in you trying to unmess you up, and that is probably cross-culturally valid. The next major phase of his life, so that's the first phase is the becoming a psychoanalyst. The second phase is kind of becoming himself. And the third phase goes from 1928 to 1944, and I call that his nuts and bolts period. He just was collecting data hour after hour and writing it up that seemed to support his basic thesis. In 1944, he had a heart attack and almost died, came back on his feet, and wrote until 1961, another 17 years. And he continues his authorship that existed before. But he does it with a lot less care for the reader. He tried to communicate his ideas in the first period, but in the second period he just says, well, I'm going to write it from the point of view of the material, and whether you guys can understand it or not is your problem. And that's why it's so difficult to read, because it's not really taking account of the standpoint of the reader. But I think he felt his time was limited and wanted to get it out. And that's why you almost need an interpreter to read that stuff. And that's kind of how I feel Edinger has made a great contribution, by really relaying it to us in a way I certainly could not have done. The other thing that's really important about the later period of life is that he really had time, I'd say, to look back and take stock on how his ideas were in conflict with the prevailing paradigm of Western science. And the big phenomenon that he discovered but really never wrote about until this last period was synchronicity. So you could say that the last period is not just his ideas, but examining the implications of his ideas that go against the Western paradigm. And as we'll see, the key figure in helping him do that was Pauli. Now, Pauli. 25 years Jung's junior. He was born in 1900. Viennese, we've talked about that. As far as his place in history, the first major date is 1927, which is the completion of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And I think we figured out last time that he went to Copenhagen in 1925, did we not, Tom, or 1920, something around there, early, mid-20s. So up to that time, you know, he had was born in Vienna, studied in Munich, got his PhD in Göttingen, was teaching in Hamburg, went to Copenhagen, developed his big idea of the fact that electrons cannot hold similar energy values in an atom, that if one's got a certain energy value, the other one can't. It's called the Pauli exclusion principle. Always reminds me of a piece of a graffiti I saw at Moose's Saloon in Kalispell, Montana, when I was 22 years old. It's funny, the things that stick in your mind. It said, "Down with the Pauli exclusion principle, strike a blow for free electrons." That has always stayed with me. Another interesting detail is, I think it's very interesting, that the same years that Jung was on his night sea journey, 1913 to 1928, which is why I've got him underlined, is the exact same years that quantum mechanics was in the process of being developed. Bohr postulated the first model of the atom as being like a solar system in 1913. And by 1927, they had finished the model. So at the same time, two new disciplines were born. There was no such thing as depth psychology before 1928. There was no such thing as quantum physics before 1927. So we're really seeing two brand new disciplines being born in our history. And I think the fact that they are paralleled historically is relevant in the fact that they're paralleled theoretically. The shift In Jung's psychology from Freud parallels the shift from the shift in physics from Newton to quantum mechanics. It's the exact same thing. And what is lost is causality. Again, neither Jung nor quantum mechanics throws out causality, but it doesn't see it as determinative to what happens. And what is that thing that makes things happen? Who knows? Why does an electron go one way one moment and one the next? We don't know. But it is recognized that movement cannot be described by causality. And I think if you're aware of this, you will hear through most psychological arguments. which are based on cause. Remember a certain pastoral counselor said at a certain Friends of Jung meeting that, you know, Jung did his work because he was sexually abused. You see? Cause, effect. And it's just ridiculous. The personality cannot be subscribed in terms of what caused it. There is something else going on. What that something else is, we're going to try to at least dance around this whole time. In other words, our knowledge of things isn't complete with causality. That's a tremendous humbling recognition to the ego. We therefore cease being engineers of somebody else's psyche. We're dealing with a process that we fundamentally don't understand, although we can get some images for it, and I think learn some of its nature so that we can cooperate with it. So you see, it's not cause-effect anymore. It's a relational model to this process. 1928, then, Pauli moved to Zurich, where he took up the chair of physics. And that, as we will see today, that's where he started having his personal crises. His mom committed suicide. His first marriage fell apart. He ended up drinking, getting in bar fights, and went to see Jung, roughly in 32. That work wasn't all that long, maybe a year or two, and after that he and Jung, I think, maintained a casual friendship, a casual correspondence. This is when the correspondence starts. Things heated up with the Nazis amassing around the German border at the beginning of the war. So Pauli got out of Switzerland, went to Princeton, and there he was awarded a Nobel Prize. We'll be talking about that today. Now, for our purposes, when Pauli comes back, you see, he comes back depressed about the war just about the time Jung is starting his major authorship. 1944, Jung was starting his major authorship, and 1946, Pauli came back. So they met twice at, you could say, nodal points of their life. One nodal point being 1928-1930, Jung just getting his feet back on the ground and Pauli having his first personal crisis. The second node was 1944-45-46, when Pauli was again in the bottom of in the belly of the whale, depressed and despairing about what his science had accomplished. And Jung was beginning his major authorship, and that's when their friendship really took hold, because the role that Jung could offer Pauli was helping him understand his dreams, and the role that Pauli could offer Jung is giving him confidence to publish his thoughts on synchronicity. And I think it gave Jung courage to hear a scientist who was at the top of his field, who was able to understand, yes, there is such a thing as synchronicity. Pauli knew that from his own life, even though it seems to conflict with all the paradigms that were and are reigning in science. Pauli said, tough, facts are what's important, let's talk about this, and that gave Jung the confidence to publish on it. And I think I would even go as far as to say it was Pauli's idea that Jung publish synchronicity. So we really owe all this work on synchronicity to Pauli's support for Jung's publishing. Something that Pauli then worked on from, again, we'll be looking at that today, from, I think, just at the end of the war until 1952. Again, he was working on this while Jung was working on all of Jung's main work, was this essay on Kepler. And we'll talk about that today. Kepler was kind of the first, one of the first physicists, or astronomers, really, who wrote mathematical laws that described the movements of the planets. Before that time, nobody really had mathematically quantified the movements of the heavens. And why that's so important for us is at that time that the scientific worldview started to take hold. And what some people would call superstition, the superstitious view of nature, got thrown out. And Kepler introduced the quote, scientific study of the heavens. Pauli was interested both in Kepler and, we'll see, the people that came before him, because Pauli could realize that the superstitious understanding of the movements of the planets prior to the way Kepler quantified them was not all that far off some of the ideas we come up with when we try to understand synchronicity. So it's like something got lost, and Pauli realized that had to be let go of, but yet it itself contained the truth, which we are coming back to in terms of synchronicity, if it can be reframed. So he went back to the point where history changed its view to see if there were any hints on how we might understand where to go from here. We'll be talking about that all through the course. That's the Kepler essay. It was a big piece of work for Pauli. 1958, Pauli died of cancer in Zurich. 1961, Jung died. So they died 3 years apart. So I went through this history to give you a feeling. Jung is getting his feet on the ground, Pauli appearing, looking for help. Pauli coming back after the war, Jung starting his major authorship, and how important that was.
Sort of a definition of synchronicity.
Pardon?
I said this is sort of a definition of synchronicity.
It is a sort of a definition. You can see there's a synchronistic relation between physics and psychology, which is why I think we're not just picking two concepts out of the air and trying to force a connection. There really is a connection here.
And then
they
have their lives synchronized.
Their lives synchronized. And they lived, you know, I don't know if you've been to Zurich, but they lived about 3 miles apart. Be like, I don't know how to describe it. Maybe Zionsville to Carmel. That's probably 1 or 3 miles, isn't it? It might be Broad Ripple. It'd be like here to Broad Ripple, really. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Two different towns, but these are teensy little towns down the Lake of Zurich. You and Kuznacht and Pauli and Tollikon. Okay. Questions? Page 13. Well, we're talking about Pauli's personal life for a little bit. First point that's made on page 13 is Pauli's difficulty with women. During his university days, it sounds like he basically spent his nights in brothels. I mean, it's said very discreetly, but if you read between the lines, he was getting drunk in cabarets and probably spending his nights there. And he had a tendency to sleep till noon. I showed you pictures of Summer Felt, did I not? Did I show you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. To give you an idea of his teacher at that time. I wanted to show you that because his teacher was apparently a very, very good-natured fellow and a very good teacher and very warm and very supportive of his students. That was his teacher at the time, and Pauli basically slept through the lectures but probably got notes from fellow students. The guy he studied with was Werner Heisenberg. They were classmates. And that's important because Heisenberg and Bohr were the two big other players in the quantum interpretation of quantum mechanics. Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And if you remember, any of you saw the play that was put on here, Copenhagen, when the war started, you see, these three guys were the ones that knew how to make a bomb or knew the physics to make a bomb. And they were all friends at one time. So after the work was done, Bohr stayed in Copenhagen. Heisenberg went back to Germany. Pauli to Zurich. Pauli refused to work on the bomb, but Heisenberg was the head of the German project to build an atomic weapon. And then Bohr apparently came over to Los Alamos and consulted with them. So it's ironic that you have these friends at one point, and the next, 15 years later, 10 years later, they were at the heart of work that could have very easily decided the outcome of the war. Had the Nazis got that bomb, you know, we'd have been goners. And it was really a miracle, probably, that we defeated the Germans before that bomb had a chance to be built. I guess it was built in a Bavarian tunnel somewhere. They had literally dug into a mountain. And I don't know whether the Allies knew it or not, but the bombing, of course, didn't affect the laboratory, but it affected stuff getting to them and slowed down the project. So it was probably a matter of months whether or not they would have gotten the bomb.
When did they come to the States, to Los Alamos? To bring their brains with them?
I don't remember when that started. Probably
43, 44,
I'm guessing. Because the bombs were August of 45.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they were band together over here. Yeah.
All those people that were thrown out of Germany were brought together over here. Pally in Princeton did not work on it, but his student, Oppenheimer, was the head of the project.
And von Braun, was he?
No, he was still in Germany. I don't think he was working with the bomb. He was working with the B-2 missile.
Oh.
So NASA then hired him.
Oh.
It's amazing how we switched sides very quickly. Yeah, he became the head of, I think he became the head of NASA research. Is that, you know that story at all, Ted?
Mm-hmm.
Werner von Braun?
I think he was really the critical
behind the technology. I don't know whether he's ahead of it or not, but he was certainly brought here, and his expertise got those missiles going up here after the war. Or rockets, I guess, really, not missiles. Now, the crisis is there near the bottom of the page. His mother died from suicide because she caught her husband with a younger woman, whom he then married. Ellie often referred to the new stepmother, who was his age, as his evil stepmother. And he was appointed a full professor of physics at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, what I called the ETH earlier. It's got a bunch of names. And he was the professor there until his death, except for Princeton. He married for the first time then, I guess he left the church in 1929. Remember, he was Jewish, half Jewish, raised Catholic, and then left the church. Married this woman, Kate Debner, whom I don't know, and that didn't last long. While all this was going on, he came up with another discovery, which I think you could say would be the forerunner of today's particle physics, that there was a particle in the nucleus of the atom that had been unaccounted for, and it was called the neutrino. Neutrino because it was neutral like the neutron. Remember, in the atom, in the nucleus, you have the proton and neutron, and then he discovered another. He didn't discover it mathematically. He could show that the results implied there was more inside the nucleus than the math would allow. So, anyway, he posited this particle, which was later found. And what's interesting, he did this, his two major discoveries were the exclusion principle and this neutrino. And he did this while his life was absolutely falling apart. He began drinking and getting in all sorts of trouble and sought Jung's help. Jung talks about Pally in a couple places. One of them is the Tavistock Lectures, which is in Volume 18. It's actually a pretty good read. It's lectures he gave to a clinic in England, I think in the 30s. And it's kind of a summary of his work. It's not the best thing he's ever done, but people often ask, you know, what should I read as introductory material? It's not bad as an introductory. It's maybe, I don't know, 80 pages or something like that. Just introducing his work to a group of psychologists, preachers, and psychiatrists at this mental health clinic in England, Tavistock Clinic. So Jung gives us a little bit of the nitty-gritty of what was going on in that interview. So 1932, now Pally's Ben Young's office. In the interview, I got a very definite impression of him. I saw that he was chock full of archaic material, and I said to myself, now I'm going to make an interesting experiment to get that material absolutely pure without any influence for myself, and therefore I won't touch it. So I sent him to a woman doctor who was then just a beginner and who did not know much about archetypal material. Thus, I was absolutely sure that she would not tamper with it. The patient was in such low spirits that he did not object to my proposition. So he worked with her and did everything she said. And this woman is somebody that I don't know. I don't think anybody I know knows her. Erna Rosenbaum, whoever she is. And they worked for about 5 months, he says here. And then Pally got his feet back on the ground. And I read conflicting stories on this, but according to him anyway, he then went to Jung for 2 years after that. And he says no interpretations worth mentioning were then attempted because the dreamer, owing to his excellent scientific training and ability, did not require any assistance. So that's the first phase of Pally's crisis. I don't know if you know this essay, but I brought it along in case. The material from that first period has been published. Jung published it in Psychology and Alchemy. And it's called Individual Dream Symbolism in Relation to Alchemy. I'll pass this around. Get my papers out of there. He doesn't mention Pally by name, but that's who it is. It's all Pally's material. I'll read you one of his dreams in here that we're talking about in a moment. Basically, what Jung does there is use Pally's dreams to demonstrate how the mandala works. It's quite a substantial essay. Two main motifs in those dreams. One's the self. The mandala appears. And you can really see how the self keeps coming back as this geometrically balanced pattern to bring balance into Pally's own life. And the other big thing in those is the anima. This is Pally's problem with women. I think I told you he used to say to his first wife, you should like me because I'm an important physicist. This is the level of his eros. Do we need to go into the anima at all? Mother's the first carrier. I'm on page 15 now. The sister can embody. She represents the soul, without which there's no life, the emotional warmth and vitality, which you can hear missing in a statement like, you should like me because I'm an important physicist. She's the archetype of life. And she creates huge disappointments. Well, we might talk about that for a minute. How does she create disappointments?
Projection?
Yeah. She draws a guy to an experience which is destructive. So you can see why Pally is going to be leery of her. Why does she do that? Animus is no different, I don't think. Maybe he operates a little differently, but I don't think it's all that different.
Well, speaking of method of expression, so through projection it finds a relationship in which to have an expression.
Yeah, but why can't she be nicer about it?
So that he learns to fit
into the group. They got touched by complex.
Because if it was just, if it's, you know, interesting and dangerous, it's more attractive. Draws the man into life. And
yeah. And I think the more the man is inclined to be cerebral, this is the way the yanima generates emotions. But, of course, at a terrible price, often. What it costs the man to understand the lesson is often very high. Sometimes it can be his ruin. You see that with political figures and so on.
One of the things that I think was in the Dust Bowl, where Jung said that there's a marriage between the shadow and the an anima that creates that double side.
Right. Yeah. When go ahead.
That's what I was saying. But did he hold? Is that something that he held to?
That's pretty standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the idea is that you could say, and I'm going to give it a slightly simple twist for the sake of discussion, but what we don't, when a guy doesn't know, then becomes attached to the anima. And usually what a man doesn't know is his own power drive. And so that's the shadow that the anima is connected to. So she will draw him into an experience to force a recognition of those sides of himself that have attached themselves to her. And that just seems to be an archetypal situation. And you see it in the dreams as what Jung calls the marriage of the anima and the shadow. So sometimes these marriage dreams, you've got to be very careful with them. Because in the unconscious, you know, it could be the anima marrying some guy. And you think, oh, it's a beautiful union. But in fact, it's a regression where the anima is getting infected with a quality of the man's life that he doesn't take responsibility for. And then she becomes destructive to weave a arrangement where he stumbles in order to then become aware of what he has disregarded. And the same, I think, for the animus. The quality that the man needs to become aware of, very often power, his power, you know, his bossiness or his greed or his need to dominate, let's say. When it's not recognized, you'll see it in the dreams that the figure that represents that marries the anima. And you see a dream of these two figures getting married. And you think, oh, whoopee, it's a union. But it's a regressive union. And what happens then, the anima is charged up with the energy that should be lived in the man's life. And then she starts getting active, arranging a liaison with a woman who will bring him down. And bring him down just to the point where he has to face the quality that he didn't want to take responsibility for. So in that sense, the anima is in the service of individuation. And, you know, from the point of view of the unconscious, that's fine. From our point of view, it's not so fine because it can be very painful. And it can actually lead to ruin. And Pali, being enormously rational, you see, is going to have one hell of an anima. Because she embodies all that irrationality that he hasn't. So every time he would say, I mean, I'm now sort of constructing a hypothetical situation, but every time he would say, you know, you should treat me right because I'm important, and not because he's been kind to the partner, that just infuriates that inner woman. She just builds up resentment because her domain is being ignored. So when she does get active, she gets active in a destructive way, which is then kind of in a way reinforces the guy's aloofness because he's got to stay away from all those feelings. See, it's much easier to go pay for sex because you don't have to deal with the emotional complications. On the other hand, I think Pally was smart enough to know he was sick of paying for sex. He did want a relationship, so he was torn. And where this is going to play a big role for us is the woman that his anima fastens on is going to be von Franz. So all that crap that he has to live out is going to surface in that relationship. On the positive side, you could say, well, the anima picked a pretty decent woman to project on, and it would have been an opportunity for him to work that through. We'll be seeing that throughout the dreams. But, you know, no matter how brilliant the guy is, his desire will bring him down. Because no mind can argue with the heart forever. Sooner or later, he's going to wake up someday and say, so what if I'm a famous physicist? I'm emotionally unsatisfied. And you can repress that for a while, but you can't repress it forever.
So like Thomas Aquinas.
Exactly. Yeah, you could say this guy is a sort of a modern Thomas Aquinas. In a way, he is, you could say he's sexually not a prude, but in a way he is because he's emotionally a prude.
Well, not prude, but immature. I mean, it just sounds like childish just to say, you just like me because I'm important. I mean, that sounds immature.
Yeah, okay. But you get the picture, what we're dealing with the guy. And you can see how that then led into the first marriage issue and why Jung then said you need to go talk to a woman.
And he didn't argue?
He was too demoralized to argue.
But we know from the biography stuff he was a pretty contentious guy.
He was very
contentious. So it's pretty much an indication of where he was.
By the time he got his feet back on the ground, by the time we fast forward to 1958, he's arguing with everybody. He's picking fights with everybody and slowly alienating all his friends one by one. So that's kind of what's on page 15. I mentioned the disappointments. On the other hand, as he says, she is a solace for all the bitterness of life. She's the great illusionist, the seductress, and also she's the source of all inspiration. She's the muse. She's what the Greeks symbolized as the muse. In other words, those brilliant ideas come in a mood, in a creative mood. So you can't create out of sheer willpower. You have to be in the mood to create. And then he says some good standard anima advice. After that long quote on 15, progress with her is only possible when the man tries to apprehend his feelings, moods, and fantasies. And then the quote, only then when this hard task has been faced, emphasize hard task, does he come to realize more and more that behind all her cruel sporting with human fate there lies something like a hidden purpose, which seems to reflect a superior knowledge of life's laws. But the man and the woman have to let themselves be churned up like this to eventually get there. You know, Jung called the shadow the apprentice piece and the anima and animus the masterpiece of individuation or growth. It is one long, drawn-out adventure. Though sometimes it doesn't seem like an adventure. And, you know, you can solve yourself the whole problem by repressing your eroticism. That's what most people do. But if you take your eros seriously, if you say, I am not going to live without this desire that makes me feel complete, then you're in for an adventure. And that's the adventure that was to be lived out with Mark Franz. We'll be looking at that. It's probably a good time for a break. What we'll do, we'll take a break, and then we'll come back. I'm going to read you the whole dream that this author refers to that actually came from the 1932 period. And let you hear what Jung said about it to kind of set the stage, because that first dream, even though it's not from the period we're looking at, does contain all the themes, and it'll give you a way to grasp what's going on. So let's take five or ten, and then we'll come back.